Hello and welcome to the post-runoff edition of the Texas Tribune Tribcast. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, joined by CEO and editor-in-chief of the Tribune, Evan Smith.
Morning for some of the lost incumbents, Elise.
Oh, that's right. And managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Ben Philpott, who's covering politics for the Tribune and KUT News. Hi, Ben.
Howdy.
No one's feeling blue but
right?
me.
Why would we feel blue? It's like watching the brackets fall apart in March Madness.
So it's like watching a lion attack an antelope.
Is Charles Perry Butler? Are we going to try to make this into a basketball thing? Was Syracuse getting defeated?
I don't think there were really any real surprises in the elections. You know, when you look at this stuff, I mean, everything.
How's that for a start, at least?
It was sort of
hijacked.
Were there any real upsets? Did you guys see something that you just were like, oh my God?
Well, let's just overview and recap real quick. Delwin Jones and Norma Chavez will no longer be returning to the Texas House.
Right. True. Voted off the island.
That's right. And then we have some general election matchups now set. Valinda Bolton will be running against Paul Workman in Southwest Austin. Larry
Malden,
Gonzalez will be the Republican opponent to Deanna Maldonado up in Williamson County.
Right.
Van Taylor is essentially
Van Taylor's on his way to Austin, Texas.
Right?
When do they? Is there a special in that race coming up now?
There is a special coming up. It's a very weird thing. They couldn't get off the ballot. Brian McCall left the legislature.
He announced he would retire, and then he resigned.
Well, he resigned in order to take this job. He's going to be the new chancellor at the Texas State University system.
Right.
So he resigns. It sets up a May election. There was no way to find out what the results of the runoff were going to be before the filing deadline for the May 8th election. So both of the candidates, Mabry Jackson and Van Taylor, filed for the May 8th election. You can't pull your name off the ballot now. So they're both on the ballot. Yeah. Van Taylor was saying before the runoff that whoever wins this runoff, the loser ought to just pull out and, you know, not make May 8th an election. So
Has Mabry Jackson said she's not going to run in the special?
She hasn't. Well, she can't not run. She can't get off the ballot.
But is she going to just basically bring the thing to a halt?
She hasn't addressed it. Yeah. I mean, all she can do is endorse him and hope that voters catch it. But,
yeah.
You know.
So you're right, though. So we have some special election, general election things that we now know, races in which there was no opponent. And, in fact, the El Paso race, right, there's no Republican there. So it's
correct. Effectively over.
State Representative Naomi Gonzalez.
Right.
And that one we thought was going to be pretty close and wound up being a nail biter.
Fewer than 400 votes separating the two, but the number of votes in total cast in that race was itself not that much.
No, it was a relatively small turnout. You know, runoffs are usually small turnout elections. They're, you know, now there's a really big exception in here in Lubbock, Texas, but runoffs are generally, these are people who, as Zach Brady put it in the Lubbock race a while back, and these are people who vote when it's raining steel balls. They just come out for anything. They'll vote for, you know, water bonds.
Right.
So, you know, you usually get low turnouts in these things. El Paso certainly adhered to the rule. Lubbock didn't. In this race where Charles Perry beat Delwin Jones in Lubbock, 16,000 plus, maybe 17,000 people voted.
Yeah, between early and on the day of.
And
they were talking about even more. We, you know, Elise and I were in Lubbock yesterday where we had the Texas Tribune College tour at mm-hmm. Tech. And Chris Wynn, the chair of the Republican Party in Lubbock County, was saying he thought it could be 20,000 or as many as 25. They were actually predicting some tsunami of people to turn out.
Wynn also mentioned he was sitting next to us at lunch and also mentioned that he didn't think Delwin was going to be able to pull it out and was correct there. So perhaps it was a lot of us in the press who thought it was going to be closer than it wound up being.
But, well, you know, by comparison, so the Plano race was fewer than 9,000 votes. I mean, so
right.
It just really depended upon where you were. And the Gonzalez-Gordon race you alluded to, Deanna Maldonado's district, it was only about 5,000 votes cast. So
right. Almost everybody, you know, that I talked to before this, and I think when you guys were out doing runoff elections around, you know, most of a runoff election is not persuading people to vote for a candidate. Most of it is persuading people who have already decided how they're going to vote to get off their couches and go vote. And, I think in every one of these races, you can just kind of go down the list and say, that one did it, that one did it, that one did it. You know, Charles Perry clearly did it. In the first round, there were 25,000 voters. There were three candidates. In the second round, there were 17,000 voters. The guy can get people off couches.
And I think to the Ben Philpott point of an earlier podcast, remember, Ben is here, by the way. Although
oh, hi. How are
silent.
You?
Silent.
Sorry. Yes.
He's zoned out for a while.
He's thinking up new ways to get us to give money to public radio before the pledge drive ends. Ben made the point earlier in the year that when you have a race in which the person who doesn't win but finishes in first gets close to 50% but doesn't get 50%, that person could be in trouble. Well, in the other Lubbock race,
right,
Mark Griffin got 48% in the first round and ended up losing, as you predicted might happen in a theoretical race. It actually happened in that case.
You know, and it's just a scary position to be in. You're at 48%, and especially if the second and third people end up lining up together politically a little better than maybe you and the second place right. person did. You know, it's just an easy jump over. If it's a us against them, and you're at 48%, and everyone else is the them, you're just in trouble, I think.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about are the two Central Texas races, because Maldonado and Bolton are both kind of in targeted seats by Republicans.
Right.
So who's kind of, who do you think is more in jeopardy?
I would guess Maldonado, just because it's Williamson County. It's a Republican county, and you know, she won last time because there was Republican infighting in the primary. You had supporters for the losing candidate in the Republican runoff not getting on board. You also had a candidate who kind of plopped down on the Republican side, plopped down in the county, was backed by Craddock and not much else.
Was that the Brian Daniel?
Yes. Didn't really have roots within that area.
But you also remember, though, that was the district in which the incumbent, Mike Cruzy, previously held the seat, very nearly lost the election
right.
before Maldonado,
right. Well,
got,
2 years before Maldonado.
Got in. And, you know, there were dynamic factors in that race that were...
There were some personality issues.
It's a personality issue. And, you know, it's she showed up in a year in which Democrats were in a good place, Republicans
right.
were, as you say, squabbling, Hispanic, school board background, you know, kind of presented very nicely. There seems to be less enthusiasm for her this time, in a year in which it's not a Democratic year but a Republican year. And they got the guy they wanted.
Well, and importantly,
right?
it's her first defense. You know,
right.
Bolton is battle-hardened. She won this district. The Republicans didn't think she should have won the district, that it should have been a Republican district. But she's defended it, and defended it successfully against moneyed attacks. Maldonado.
And a last name.
Right.
And Keel.
Right. And Keel, which is a big Travis County name. Yeah, that year at the ballot, I think everybody on the ballot was named Keel, weren't they?
Yeah, right.
In Maldonado's case, she's defending for the first time. She won, as you said, in the Obama year. It was kind of an upset. Well, it wasn't kind of an upset. It was an upset. And Gonzalez is the Republicans' answer to it. Was that a real election? Did it really shift to the Democrats? Or is Deanna Maldonado an anomaly?
And by the way, the distance in votes, the difference in support in the runoff between Gordon and Gonzalez is significant. Gonzalez trounced him. It wasn't close. So if the Gordon people are not enthusiastic about Gonzalez, it's less important than if this were a nail biter.
Though it was interesting because Gordon actually did finish first on March 2nd, and so
that was again
was
a case,
same,
kind of the Philpott rule now and forever, Chris.
You know, although I got to say, the Gonzalez aimed, you know, like 30 bazookas at Gordon. You know,
oh Lord, yeah,
holy cow, the television advertising in that thing. You know,
I have friends that have, you know, rewallpapered their bathrooms with the flyers that they got, the direct mail that they got from this race.
That is not exactly a compliment.
Well, you know, Larry Gonzalez used to be in the direct mail business. So it's not completely surprising that Larry Gonzalez
now he's in the wallpaper business.
Yeah,
right.
People used to pay him right. for direct mail. Now he pays people for direct mail.
Yeah.
So
can we talk about the Norman Naomi race?
This is
like, you know, now batting cleanup. I'll miss her, Norma.
Of course.
Won't we all?
Yeah. Hey, I don't have a story today. Go talk to Norma.
Right.
Right.
B, I think, and you know, the Tribune will soon, perhaps as soon as tomorrow, have this very story. I think there's a really great conversation to be had about what who lost Norma, they would say in the kind of literary terms. Who lost Norma? If you think of it as a multiple choice question, was it A, Payback's a bitch? She had been really difficult to work with, according to her colleagues in the El Paso delegation, and this was essentially bad karma, you know, leeching onto her shores. B, was the gay thing, in quotes, the issue of Norma Chavez raising the specter of Naomi Gonzalez's sexual orientation, the thing that really, but for that, Norma would have squeaked this out,
mm-hmm.
you know? C, was this, as Norma predicted, really a Republican victory and not a Democratic victory, since institutionally Texans for Lawsuit Reform was out in force in El Paso to help Naomi get elected? Norma charged in the last days of the campaign, you're really electing a Republican if you elect Naomi Gonzalez. So is that what it was ultimately? I mean, what was it that caused Norma to lose?
You can only behave like that for a certain amount of time before everybody gets tired of your stuff, and they got tired of her stuff. I think they were watching Norma, and Norma just gave voters a bill of particulars. Naomi Gonzalez read the bill of particulars. That's all she did. Yeah. You know, she just, you know, Norma went out and did stuff for years. Naomi read this list of stuff that Norma had done. Every elected official, save for a couple, almost every elected official in El Paso who Norma had crossed at some point in the last 10 or 12 or 15 or 20 years came out and said,
enough.
Vote against Norma, enough.
Right.
I think it was just inexorable. I think it was just a tie.
How soon before Marissa Marquez texts her, you are not my colleague.
You are not my colleague, right? Yeah.
And I found the whole sexuality thing so unpleasant. You know, just for her to raise it as an issue. And then apparently, I believe it was Zaira Torres' story in the El Paso Times, the Sunday story, that said something about how Chavez said, you know, I've come to terms with my biker community. She should come to terms with her gay community or something like that.
Right.
And it was like equating being a biker with being homosexual. I mean, there was just such outlandish stuff going around that I just found, you know, pretty unpleasant towards the end of that.
It was messed up. It was, you know, it was just one of those things where, you know, if you go to the voters and you finally say at the end of an election, you have candidate A, you have candidate B, you got to give them a reason to vote for the candidate that they're voting for. And Norma just took away all the reasons to vote for her.
Ben, you got something you want to jump in on here?
I was just thinking that it's kind of like with Senator Brimer. I mean, losing to Wendy Davis. It was one of those things where he just over and over again had done just enough to irritate the people within his district. And then you had a fresh face come along and who didn't have a slate of did this or did that.
He's seen her one too many times.
Ross, I want to ask you about the consequence of all of this. Because, you know, we know that this week we saw this new group of Republicans band together, independent Republican conservatives or conservative Republicans of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
They are trying to, as you've said, extend a hand rightward and bring in some of the movement folks to what we know as the structure of the Republican Party to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, was your exact phrase. We see a trade of Delwin for Charles Perry. We see a trade of Brian McCall for Van Taylor. We have the prospect of a trade in other races, less conservative, more moderate for more conservative, less moderate.
Mm-hmm.
Make sense of all of this. What is the net effect of what we've seen so far?
You know, if you took what we've sort of used shorthand as the Tea Party, I think what you really have is an anti-establishment conservative vote. It's the same vote in some ways that showed up in 1992 for Ross Perot. In fact, if you go to Tea Party rallies and nullification rallies, I've been to a half dozen of them, there's still United We Stand t-shirts out there. You know, I've been mad for 20 years. They've got the old Ross Perot t-shirts on. And I think that the candidates who have given them a place, and there's some mainstream candidates, notably the governor of the state of Texas, who've given these people sort of a place in the campaign and have sort of, you know, I share your views, I share your concerns. You know, it's kind of this wing of the Republican Party that's upset in a libertarian way with the way Republicans got into office. And, you know, this isn't a social conservative movement. This is more like a libertarian or budget conservative movement. We put a bunch of Republicans in, government got bigger, it got more expensive, taxes went up, and we have this big deficit. And the candidates that took advantage of this, for the most part, won. Now, the notable exception last night was Rick Green, who didn't win. But I went to a thing in Lubbock a couple of weeks ago where a candidate forum, and they were all sort of forming around Rick Green being out there. And everybody else at that forum won. John Frullo won his race in the Carl Isaac seat in Lubbock. He's got a Democratic opponent, but it's a Republican district. Charles Perry won his race. Carl Isaac was there. This group of Republicans that has formed up has sort of, I think this is their recognition that in order to keep the conservatives together against the liberals in November, they need to start patching this thing up. And so Dan Patrick and I'm forgetting the name of the group off the top of my head. It had independent and conservative.
It's either ERCOT or ICROT. It's
ICROT,
one of the two.
Independent Conservative Republicans of Texas.
Right, which is every buzzword except for of. Everyone's a buzzword except for of. And, you know, I think they're trying to accommodate this, put the party back together, you know, form a vanguard that they can take the Obama Democrats down.
And you don't take the presence of 44 Republicans, more than half of the House, on this group's list of charter members. Mm-hmm. None of the 44 are ABCs. None of the Polo Road Massacre crowd are on that list. You don't take this as another reporter in the Capitol suggested this week, a sign that Joe Strauss may have a speaker's race on his hands.
No, I think political reporters, I include myself in this, political reporters have walked out to a plate of speaker's race so many times that we've walked out to dinner and we've looked at the plate and, you know, we see something else and, wow, that's a funny-looking speaker's race. I don't think there is a speaker's race right now. I think it takes two or three terms in that office or a scandal to overturn a speaker, and I just don't see it at this point. There are some people who are on the outs because Joe Strauss's team won last year in the Polo Road Massacre. But I don't think they have the numbers. I don't think you can – I don't see any way you can put this together and put together the numbers behind a speaker who's not Joe Strauss as long as you have a Republican majority, which I think we're going to have, and as long as that Republican majority isn't so overwhelming that the conservatives take over the party, and I don't think we're going to have that either.
It looks to me like it's a little bit of, this group is getting out in front of what Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour said over the weekend in New Orleans, which is, look, you Tea Party conservatives, don't make the mistake of breaking away from the party. Let's all be friends here, because if we don't, then Obama wins. So this is, a Texas group saying we're going to start trying to find that united point amongst us.
Right. But one of the things that the group said, which I thought was very interesting, is we consider the sovereignty of Texas to trump party nationally or sovereignty of the country. I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, but sovereignty of the country. Basically,
George Wallace's American Party.
Well, I mean, it's really not too difficult to look at the core principles articulated by the formation of this group or the charter members as this group was formed. It's not too difficult to look at them and go, wow, I mean, this isn't just a restatement of the Republican Party platform. There's, sovereignty. Remember, we're coming up upon the one-year anniversary where the other S-word, secession, was floated tomorrow.
Right.
You know, it's interesting to hear. I mean, it's not just also people on the farthest rightward flank of the party. You know, Bob Duncan on the Senate side, just as an example. You got a bunch of people on this list, and you kind of go, wow, sovereignty of Texas trumps everything else. That's effectively what this group is saying. It's not something. I don't know what it is exactly,
it is something. You know, the math lesson here, to go back to Ben's point for a second, the math lesson here is that in 1992, in that earlier election, Ross Perot got around 20%, and he took the presidency away from the Republicans. Bill Clinton won that election.
Right.
And the people who voted for Ross Perot arguably, were more inclined to vote for a George H.W. Bush than for a Bill Clinton.
Which raises the question of Medina. Did Medina take away a possible, Republican nomination from Kay, though, in the same way?
The person who took the Republican nomination from Kay was Kay.
But Medina did still get 18% of the vote. So were those new voters or were...
Everybody can have a different opinion on this. I don't know of anything, any good science here. But, my sense of that was if you were a Medina voter, you were probably closer to Perry than you were to Hutchison.
Right.
Perry did break 50% this time. And he broke it with two serious opponents, one of whom attracted attention and, a lot of press, Deborah Medina, and one of whom spent, $20 million or $25 million on a famously awful campaign. But Perry's done a pretty good job of accommodating, this party. The first guy who said secession might have been Rick Perry, I think. So I think he's out in front of a lot of Republicans in Texas, and I think in the context of what we're talking about, Perry seems to be the guy right now who figured this out first.
Well, maybe this whole thing is just, let's play hypotheticals here. Of course, Governor Rick Perry is not running for president, but let's say he does. And let's say he wins. Maybe this is just Senator Patrick's way of setting himself up as the void filler in the state of Texas. He's the kingmaker, or not the kingmaker, he's the king of this little fiefdom that's been
never
created.
Never underestimate self-interest in politics.
Right. And
he's Eli Wallach in the third Godfather movie passing out,
exactly.
Don't worry, I'll talk to him, he says to everybody. I'll bring the warring parties together. But, remember what happened to him. He got to poison cannoli in the end. So
all I remember about that movie is how bad Sophia was.
You know what? This is a topic for another podcast. I can defend that movie credibly. Wait, we have to speaking of how bad somebody was, we have to talk about Rick Green before we
got to come
bring
to
the podcast to a close. The difference with Rick Green and a lot of these other folks you referred to who won yesterday was that you didn't have the likes of Craig Enoch and Tom Phillips saying the sky is falling at the prospect of Charles Perry winning, or at the prospect of John Frullo winning, or at the prospect of Van Taylor winning. But you had the most frontal assault on a Republican nominee by the Republican candidate,
right,
by the Republican establishment that I have seen in a very long time.
Well, you can offend the honor of the Supreme Court. Apparently, you can't offend the honor of the Texas House or the Texas
Jeepers.
Senate or the U.S. Congress.
This guy, and you know, you
had the Focus Factor commercial.
I think Rick Green had his defenders, and I was actually surprised in the end that Rick Green came close to winning, because I thought that with all the stuff that's out there,
I actually thought there was a really good chance he would win.
Right.
Last night.
The compound adjective you don't want attached to your name in stories leading up to runoff is baggage laden.
Right.
Which seemed to be in every story about him and about this race. Guy came pretty close. Guy with that much baggage. Samsonite has less baggage than Rick Green. Guy came close to winning. And it was partly because the establishment turned on him.
Well, but you know, I think I remember seeing some articles back from when the Republicans were losing Congress, that a lot of people were complaining, look, there were at times religious conservatives with few other attributes being elected to Congress, to state races, and when they got there, they didn't have much else other than their conservative credentials and no ability to really govern. And it cost, the idea of Republicans going up to D.C., not really being Republicans, blowing up the budget and everything. I think they saw Rick Green possibly as another one of those. We can elect someone with no credentials who might do such a bad job that it will hurt the brand.
Well, the fact is, Morgan Smith and our staff actually earlier this week floated the possibility that the best chance for the Democrats to win their first statewide office since 1994
was Rick Green
getting the nomination.
You know, all of those judges that you mentioned have been on the Supreme Court when somebody goofy got elected to the court, or have been on one of the state's two high courts when somebody goofy from the Republican Party got elected. We had Steve Mansfield, who kept his dogs, his two Pomeranians, in his station wagon in the parking garage.
At least he didn't strap them to the roof.
You know, yeah, exactly. Right. Didn't do a Romney here. And then we had Steve Smith, who was, actually turned out to be a better judge in some ways than a lot of the opponents thought. But he was a total wild card. This is the guy who beat Xavier Rodriguez,
right.
A lot of the judges over there just, it's sort of, I don't know, it's a very establishment idea, but the very idea that someone who doesn't have experience should be on this court. Now, what happened in the Republican primary was they had six candidates for this job. Four of them were appellate judges. Those were the four that lost. Mm-hmm. And the two people that got into the runoff were the district court judge, Deborah Lehrman, and Rick Green, who apparently has never spent a day in court as a lawyer. So...
Maybe you should replace Conan O'Brien. That was good.
I hear there's a channel looking.
Yeah, right.
All right. If you have any comments or questions for the podcast, you can always email us at podcasts@texastribune.org. And on behalf of Evan Ross and Ben, I'm Elise. Thank you for listening.